My name is Len Gill, and I'm your chairman. I'm joined today by my fellow directors and members of Infigen's executive team. Today, you'll have an opportunity to hear a business update from our Managing Director, Ross Rolfe, vote on the resolutions outlined in the notice of meeting, and ask questions of the management team and the board. Our meeting today takes place in Gadigal country. I would like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, traditional custodians of this land, and pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Our company secretary advises that a quorum of security holders is present. I now declare the Infigen Annual General Meeting open. The proxy votes received for today's resolutions have been inspected by our security registry, and all validly lodged proxies have been accepted. The numbers of proxy votes for each resolution will be displayed on the screen as we deal with each resolution. As chairman, I will cast all undirected proxies that I hold in favor of the relevant resolutions. Before we start the formal business of the meeting, I would like to introduce the board of directors. Karen Smith-Pomeroy, if you can just identify yourself, joined the board as an independent non-executive director in December 2018, and Karen is also a member of the Audit, Risk and Compliance Committee. As a new director on the board, Karen offers herself for election at this AGM. Karen has significant experience as a senior executive in the financial services sector and in more than 10 years' experience working directly with energy companies. She has specific expertise in risk management and has been an invaluable addition to our board. Emma Stein joined the board as an independent non-executive director in September 2017. Emma is chairman of the Audit, Risk and Compliance Committee and a member of the Nomination and Remuneration Committee. Mark Chalew joined the board as an independent non-executive director in September 2017. Mark is chairman of the Nomination and Remuneration Committee and a member of the Audit, Risk and Compliance Committee. One of our board members, Philip Green, is not able to be present with us today, and he sends his apologies. Phil is the nominee director of the Children's Investment Master Fund, a firm which represents 33% of our issued securities. Phil has been a non-executive director since November 2010, and is a member of the Audit, Risk and Compliance Committee. Ross Rolfe is our Managing Director and Chief Executive Officer. Ross has been in that role since late 2016 and was a non-executive director from 2011. Sylvia Wiggins is our Executive Director of Finance and Commercial. Sylvia was appointed in May 2017. Sylvia was also previously a non-executive director appointed in April 2016. Sylvia retires by rotation at this AGM and offers herself for re-election. Further information regarding the experience and qualifications of each director is included in the annual report. We are joined today by Infigen's Company Secretary David Richardson and by members of Infigen's senior management team. The company's external auditor, PricewaterhouseCoopers, is present today, represented by Craig Thomason, and I thank him for his attendance. FY19 was a transformative year for Infigen. 3 years ago, we articulated the need for Infigen to undertake a significant transformation of its business strategy. At that time, it had become evident that as Infigen's historic power purchase agreements matured, it would be impossible to recontract at equivalent prices and terms. And in addition, high and volatile merchant electricity prices were incentivising commercial and industrial customers to look for new retailers that could offer reliable and competitively priced energy. Against this backdrop, we began the journey of transitioning from developer and operator of wind farms, supplying energy and LGCs to retailers under run-of-plant PPAs, towards an energy market participant, delivering firm supplies of energy directly to commercial and industrial customers from renewable generation. Our business model has been described as the utility of the future. While this strategic transition has been underway for 3 years, FY19 saw the delivery of several major pillars of the strategy. During the year, we grew our own production with the delivery of the Budangaroo Wind Farm. We entered into our first agreements to contract renewable energy supply from third parties under our capital-light model. We built and acquired the South Australian Battery and the Smithfield Open Cycle Gas Turbine in New South Wales, and agreed to lease the South Australian gas turbines, introducing 268 megawatts of fast-start capacity into our portfolio. We have substantially grown our commercial and industrial customer base. From January 2020, we will have over 400 different billing sites across the national electricity market. We grew our earnings and continued to reduce debt, and we were pleased to be able to reintroduce distributions. Although it has been a truly transformative 12 months, the team continues to consolidate our past achievements and build momentum in pursuing new and emerging opportunities in the NEM. At Infigen, our purpose is to lead Australia's clean energy future. While other companies have a strategy to transition in response to the transformation that is occurring in the energy sector, we have now completed the transition of our business model. We are now well positioned to significantly grow our company and its customer base. Our plan for the next phase of our ongoing growth is reasonably simple. We plan to source an additional 600 to 700 megawatts of variable renewable energy capacity, equivalent to a doubling of our renewable volumes, and use our flexible fast start assets to contract around 70 to 80% of that energy to Australia's commercial and industrial businesses. We believe that this growth in contracted revenues will continue to improve the quality and the quantity of earnings that you, our security holders, will receive over the long term. The board and management at Infigen believe that sustainability is critical to our long-term success. We see the management of environmental, social, and governance risks as central to delivering strong risk-adjusted returns for our investors. At Infigen, safety has always been and will always be our first priority. I am disappointed to share with you that on Thursday, 3rd of October 2019, Infigen had its first lost time injury in 27 months. A technician was involved in a workplace accident at the Smithfield Open Cycle Gas Turbine facility. The injury was sustained due to a fall and was incurred during routine maintenance activities. Fortunately, the technician is recovering well and is expected to return to light duties in the near future. Management has conducted a taproot investigation to identify what can be done to reduce or eliminate the risk of this type of incident recurring, and the board will oversee the implementation of any identified measures to improve our safety performance going forward. In FY19, Infigen undertook an extensive employee engagement survey designed to provide the board and management with information to develop an engaged and high-performance workforce. This survey was conducted in February 2019 and showed pleasing results. In September 2019, another pulse survey was conducted, and it was encouraging to see further growth in employee engagement. Job satisfaction and current motivation are now tracking at 83% and 86% respectively, with the employee net promoter score a very compelling 55%. These results are all the more impressive given the 92% participation rate. Over the last 3 years, our business model has transitioned, and as a result, our stakeholder needs have changed. We recognise that our corporate values and behaviours must evolve accordingly. In FY19 and into FY20, an employee-led working group engaged all staff in defining the core values that Infigen, its employees, its management and its directors must embrace in order to meet the needs of our stakeholders and drive the sustainable delivery of our strategy. This initiative has engaged Infogen's entire workforce at numerous points, and the board has been pleased with the results, with the progress to date. Whilst the work is ongoing, we look forward to sharing more with you in 2020. At Infogen, we coexist with the local communities and landholders who host our assets. We see ourselves in long-term partnership with these communities and seek to contribute towards achieving common goals. In FY19, we contributed to 45 community projects with $338,000 of combined value. And in addition, the construction of the Badangara Wind Farm saw $7 million spent and 37 jobs created in the local community. Finally, in FY19, Infogen made additional environmental commitments as we lead by example in Australia's clean energy transition. We source 100% of our office and wind farm site power from renewable sources, and by FY25, we have the ambitious target of offsetting all our Scope 1 and Scope 2 carbon emissions. In December 2018, we welcomed Karen Smith Pomeroy to the board as an independent director. This completes the process of board renewal begun in mid-2017. The board now has 7 members, with the majority independent. We believe the board has the right balance of energy industry expertise, as well as experience in risk management, finance, governance and policy development, to refine and oversee the delivery of Infogen's strategy, developed in response to Australia's rapidly evolving energy market. The board would like to thank security holders for the favourable support received for the remuneration policy at the 2018 AGM. No changes have been made to the policy in FY19. The remuneration framework balances incentives between delivery of the holistic business strategy, annual financial outcomes and long-term security holder returns. Before I close, I would like to comment on some of the issues facing the industry's regulatory and policy environment. We have numerous reviews of the market and transmission frameworks underway to ensure they are fit for purpose for the energy market today and tomorrow. Infogen is actively contributing to those. We also have numerous investment and policy decisions being made by governments which are impacting investor confidence. From the 1990s, governments moved to restructure their state-owned utilities and create the NEM. The deregulated and restructured electricity industry has delivered significant benefits with improvements in operational efficiency, extensions of asset lives and investment in new assets utilising private sector capital. Public sector capital has been free to be deployed elsewhere, as we see in the major infrastructure programs that have been implemented by governments across the decades since the market was created. From the outset, various bodies, most notably the Industry Commission, identified the need for competitive neutrality between governments and their SOEs and the private companies in order to attract private sector capital. This principle was embraced by federal and all state governments at the time. It is of considerable concern to private sector investors that in recent years this principle seems to be increasingly compromised by governments deciding to fund or underwrite various pet projects without regard for the impact of such interventions on the dynamics of our competitive market or the Australian taxpayers' economic interests. Updating the architecture of the national electricity market is essential to deal with the changes arising from the need to reduce our carbon footprint and changes in generation technologies. Updating the market architecture will, however, not be sufficient on its own to reduce the concern of investors. Over the next 20 years, approximately 15 gigawatts of ageing coal plant needs to be replaced, requiring billions of dollars. Unless governments intend to underwrite or fund the bulk of it, We would urge all governments to recommit to the principle of competitive neutrality and cease trying to pick winners at unknown but potentially very substantial cost to the taxpayer and with suboptimal outcomes for the energy system. Absent this commitment, perhaps government members proposing these projects would be prepared to commit their individual superannuation entitlements to funding these, which we are told deliver a commercial return. This would certainly sharpen the focus on the commerciality of these proposals. Shareholders will recall that a little over 12 months ago, we were close to having a framework that allowed the integration of carbon abatement and reliability into the national energy market, the National Energy Guarantee. While this framework has gone the way of other failed attempts, the pressures driving this need have only increased. In the stationary energy sector, technology change is driving the substitution of ageing coal plant with renewable energy, supported by flexible, dispatchable plant. Infogen's business has been positioned to capture the opportunity presented by this fundamental change. The change in technology also means that the electricity sector now offers a means of delivering more carbon abatement than its current sectoral obligation at lower costs than alternatives. If it did, the sector would assist Australia to deliver on its carbon abatement commitments, current and future, while reducing the burden on other sectors of the economy, which have either higher cost or even no viable substitution options. It can thus be expected that the pressure to adopt a more holistic approach to carbon abatement will continue to grow. In closing, FY19 was a transformational year for Infogen. The year marked the transition from an owner and operator of wind farms to the utility of the future. We are well positioned to grow our business. I would like to thank Ross Rolfe for his judicious, determined and energetic leadership through this strategic transition. And I would like to thank all Infogen executives and staff for their very significant contributions over the last 12 months. I thank my fellow directors for their diligence, focus and their support. And finally, I thank you, our security holders, for your ongoing support. I now invite Managing Director Ross Rolfe to address the meeting.
Thank you and good morning, everyone. As Len reported, FY19 has been a year of significant achievement for Infogen. This year, we've not only produced strong financial results, but we've also delivered several major pillars of our corporate strategy. Many of you will recall that Infogen commenced the process of shifting away from its legacy business model some 3 years ago. Over this period, we've transitioned from an owner and operator of wind farms, selling our production under long-term run-of-plant PPAs to energy retailers towards a vertically integrated utility of the future. Now we can and do contract to sell firm supplies of clean energy at fixed prices to a diverse range of C&I and wholesale market customers. Since adopting a change of corporate strategy in FY17, we've progressively laid the foundations upon which to execute our business plan. We commenced the process of expanding our pool of renewable generation for sale in FY17 by committing to fund the 113-megawatt wind farm at Budangara in central western New South Wales. In FY18, we refinanced our legacy debt facility. This was a critical first step in transitioning our business model. Our new corporate loan enabled us to operate our existing suite of assets as a portfolio, allowing us to more effectively manage the risks involved in offering firm supplies of energy to a broader customer base. Concurrently with our refinancing, we adopted a capital-light management strategy that has enabled us to increase our renewable generation without burdening our own balance sheet. The capital-light approach has allowed us to expand our resources of renewable generation as an off-taker while at the same time investing directly in physical firming plant. Our capital management strategy has meant, therefore, that we've been able to pursue our broader range of goals of ongoing deleveraging and the return of capital to our security holders while concurrently delivering our plans for growth. In FY19, we've seen the benefits of this capital strategy reflected in the business's performance, both operationally and strategically. Key achievements in FY19 include, first, we saw the introduction of additional volumes of renewable generation for sale into our portfolio. We were pleased to successfully commission our Budangaroo Wind Farm in Q3 FY19 and commence receiving the revenues from its generation. In FY19, we contracted to receive the renewable generation for 5 years from the 30-megawatt Kiata Wind Farm in Victoria, a project that had been independently developed by John Laing and Windlab. This project provided an ideal opportunity to prudently enter the Victorian C&I market by applying our capital-light financing model. We also adapted the capital-light model to support the commercialisation of one of our own projects from our development pipeline, the 57-megawatt Cherry Tree Wind Farm, which further expanded our capacity in Victoria. In combination, these initiatives, once all fully operational, will increase the pool of renewable generation available for sale by 200 megawatts of nameplate capacity. Secondly, and importantly in FY19 and early FY20, we delivered core elements of our strategy to obtain access to dispatchable firming assets. These flexible fast start machines enable us to add value to renewable production by managing the risks of contracting to supply firm energy to customers from intermittent generation. Their performance versatility will also enable them to respond to likely future market signals to maintain the stability and the integrity of the system as a whole. These performance capabilities are, in our view, likely to become increasingly valuable as the energy supply system and its market continues to evolve. Our specific investments in such capacity included: we financed and constructed the 25-megawatt, 52-megawatt-hour Tesla battery at Lake Bonnie in South Australia. This project is now energised and approaching practical completion. We acquired the Smithfield open cycle gas turbine, providing us with 123 megawatts of fast start capacity in New South Wales. And in August 2019, we entered into an agreement to lease 120 megawatts of gas peaking capacity in South Australia for 25 years. With access to these machines and a growing customer base, we are now positioned to procure an additional 600 to 700 megawatts of intermittent renewable capacity in New South Wales and South Australia under our capital light model and sell under firm supply contracts. Slide 11 graphically illustrates the magnitude of the growth opportunity in the market for which Infigen is now well placed to compete. The chart on the left-hand side shows our existing renewable generation by channel to market, PPAs, commercial industrial customer sales, and merchant or pool sales. As you can see, we've successfully grown C&I sales significantly from FY17 through to FY19. The chart on the right-hand side illustrates the potential future growth opportunity. It shows that the firming portfolio enables us to confidently double the amount of renewable energy we supply to the market. Critically, these assets also allow us to sell 70 to 80% of that expanded volume into medium to long-term supply contracts with C&I customers. These contracts allow our customers to have certainty over their energy costs while simultaneously providing Infigen investors with greater confidence in the quality of the company's long-term revenues. It's this growth opportunity that we're focused on delivering in the short to medium term. The pool of C&I customers in the national electricity market is very significant. Residential loads form less than 30% of energy demand. Starting with one metered site 3 years ago, we now have a portfolio of over 400 metered sites spanning economic activities such as mining, processing, universities and local councils. To enable us to supply a wider pool of customers, we've invested in our customer billing system and our customer service capabilities. These systems and people will enhance the services we offer our customers by providing advanced analytics, multi-site functionality, and personal account management. When considering the level of confidence we can have in executing our sales strategy, it's important to acknowledge that we don't win every customer. We don't win every customer tender, not by a long shot. But our key challenge in servicing C&I markets has been a lack of product rather than a lack of customers. A nice problem to have, and one that underpins our growth objectives. It's also worth observing that as far as customer behaviour is concerned, there appears to be a growing number of energy users who are turning their minds to their own ESG objectives when it comes to electricity supply. We expect this market will continue to grow in parallel with community support for sustainable investments and socially responsible corporate conduct. The increasing focus on the ESG may also have positive implications for the LGC market. Right now, LGCs are trading at $50 plus per certificate. But as LGC prices moderate, an increasing number of our customers, we expect, will seek to reduce their greenhouse footprint on a voluntary basis. We're already seeing positive movements in this direction starting to appear, and subject to price, we believe the trend is likely to continue. Should Australia, of course, ultimately develop a coherent policy to deliver its obligations under the Paris Agreement, then this movement will, we expect, gain further momentum. We acknowledge that the introduction of firming assets into our portfolio will increase our own emissions intensity. Once the SA gas turbines are integrated into the portfolio, we expect our emissions intensity to be approximately 0.04 tonnes of CO2 per megawatt hour, a level that is just 5% of the average of our peers in the NEM. We are, however, committed to a low emissions future, and as a result, we are targeting carbon neutrality for our entire business by FY25. This commitment is, we believe, an industry first for a vertically integrated energy retailer in Australia. We're pleased to be able to report that these strategic achievements have been accompanied by and contributed to strong financial results. In FY19, net revenue increased to $229.3 million, 9% higher than FY18. Just as importantly, the contracted portion of the revenue increased by 13% to $182 million, reflecting our success in providing reliable and competitively priced clean energy to Australian businesses. This growth in revenue had a high conversion into EBITDA, which at $165.4 million was 11% higher than FY18. NPAT was slightly lower at $40.9 million, largely reflecting the impact of a $9.9 million impairment to our development portfolio, which we announced in December 2018. Net operating cash flow was strong at $144.4 million. This cash generation allowed us to build our growth to fund our growth activities while also improving our net debt to EBITDA ratio. As we pursue our goal of supplying clean energy to Australian businesses and industry, we've successfully increased the volume of production sold. We're therefore pleased to report that in FY19, we sold 20% more renewable energy than the prior year. This not only bolstered our results, but also contributed to the decarbonisation of Australia's power system. As we deliver our growth strategy, we continue to focus on ongoing deleveraging. In line with our capital management policy, in FY19, we paid down $41 million of gross debt and are scheduled to pay down an additional $54 million in FY20. Taken together, these strategic and financial outcomes enable the board to reintroduce distributions of 1 cent per security per half year. The first distribution was declared with respect to the half year ending 30 June 2019. Looking forward, Infigen's strategy remains firmly rooted in the belief that the process of transitioning towards a low carbon future is inexorable. The factors that support such a conclusion include, first, the ageing fleet of coal-fired generators will progressively reach the end of their service life over the next two decades. The pace at which this plant retires may well accelerate, depending upon the rate at which increasing volumes of renewable enter the market. Renewable generators with very low, short-run, marginal cost structures place significant commercial pressure on inflexible baseload thermal plant with high fixed costs, onerous ongoing overhaul costs, and uncertain marginal running costs. We acknowledge that there are certain proposals that have been mooted by government to extend the life of particular existing coal-fired generators. We do not consider, however, that such proposals, if they happen, will produce any significant change in the direction of the transformation that is underway. Measures to preserve the service life of individual plants are likely to merely change the retirement sequence of competing coal-fired generators with little, if no, apparent benefit to the system. Secondly, the price outlook for gas in the Australian domestic market is likely to result in a relatively limited, albeit critical, contribution from gas-fired generation in the market in the short to medium run. In the longer run, it seems likely that combined cycle gas machines may need to play a greater role in maintaining the functional integrity of the system as more and more coal-fired plant exits. The need for such intermediate or flexible semi-baseload capacity and its volume will likely depend upon the density and spatial distribution of new renewable generation, the emergence of commercially competitive storage technologies, and the strength of the grid. Thirdly, the cost and performance of renewables and battery storage is likely to continue to improve and will result in an increasing volume of renewable generation at both the residential and utility scale. Finally, community concern in relation to the impacts of climate change is likely to continue to rise, resulting in commercial, if not political, pressure to reduce emissions, not just from the stationary energy sector, but from other higher emitting sectors such as transport and agriculture. In this regard, the stationary energy sector offers the lowest cost solution to reducing Australia's overall emissions profile and should rationally play a relatively greater role in carbon abatement. We can only hope that in due course, policymakers will see the wisdom of facilitating this outcome through the introduction of a coherent national emissions reduction policy framework that sets a trajectory based on sound science and efficient economics. In these circumstances, Infigen's strategy is to source low-cost renewable generation from across a portfolio of assets with complementary production profiles, supported by firming plant to reliably supply a growing base of industrial customers with clean energy at a fixed price. We believe that the direction of our strategy, which is based on power system and market fundamentals, is robust. Hence, we remain disciplined in its pursuit and tactically flexible in its execution. Despite our confidence in the general direction of the market transformation and our belief in the efficacy of our own strategy, the transition pathway is not always paved and shady. I will offer commentary on three key challenges that overshadow our journey. First, as I discussed at last year's AGM, the issues with grid connection have become significantly more complex. This results from the introduction of new forms of non-synchronous generation into a grid that was designed to support a very different technology mix. The AEMC, the AEMO, the network owners and the generators are all grappling with the challenges that this presents. As a result, over the last 12 months, the vast majority of development projects have experienced significant delays in receiving their approvals to connect. In some cases, project proponents have been required to introduce additional capital commitments to manage the impact of connection on grid stability. In other cases, developers have been negatively impacted by changes to marginal loss factors that have reduced the volume of energy that they can export. As the grid mutates in response to the pressures associated with absorbing an efflorescence of distributed renewable generation, new and sometimes complex challenges must be anticipated. As a long-term market participant, we invest considerable resources in understanding the changing system dynamics and the risks they produce. We expect this capability to become increasingly important as the market evolves. Secondly, the sovereign risk profile of the sector requires careful assessment when considering investment in new capacity. The higher prices for energy that have resulted from the reduced supply associated with the retirement of large coal-fired generators in recent years and the perceived risk to future supply have led to a frenzied public debate, a debate that has unfortunately been characterised by far more heat than light. In volatile political conditions, a wide-ranging set of proposals to restructure the industry, intervene in commercial decision-making, alter the fundamental market design, or introduce radical rule changes have been canvassed by policymakers and regulators. Most of these initiatives tend to be targeted at solving specific perceived problems without necessarily fully understanding the implications of such proposed solutions for the integrity of the system as a whole or the viability of the market that trades its output. Of particular concern is the lack of transparent and objective analysis of the costs and risks associated with each such initiative and how they are to be allocated between the consumer and the citizen as taxpayer. This analysis and continued commitment from government to a competitively and continued commitment from government to a competitively neutral market is critical to maintaining investor confidence, as Len discussed in his opening remarks. Market confidence needs to be a guiding principle for policymakers as they contemplate the respective roles to be played by the public and the private sector in transforming the system over the short, medium and long run. Thirdly, the divisive public policy debate has left the nation without a credible framework through which to meet its international commitment to the Paris Agreement, or that would form the basis of a viable national response to emissions reduction. A coherent long-term market-based emissions policy remains elusive, and though it should be a critical element of an integrated strategy that is likely to deliver a smooth transition to a low-carbon future. In these circumstances, Infogen continues to seek to influence the direction of policy change through active participation, formally and informally, at the political and officials levels of government and with the policy, advisory and regulatory agencies. For those of you who are interested in the detail of these issues that are under deliberation and our perspective on them, they are readily available on our website. As a general principle, we advocate caution in introducing radical change to the structure and functioning of the market. In the current circumstances, we do, however, consider that some incremental rule changes are appropriate in response to changing market conditions. We believe that there is a need for the development of new market-based products to incentivise investment in measures that enhance the stability of the grid. The current confused nature of the federalised policy process and the absence of unified position amongst the regulatory bodies militates in favour of a coordinated national approach. This is a function that the Energy Security Board is showing itself to be best placed to deliver. Infogen will therefore continue to work closely through our industry bodies and directly with policymakers to support the work of the ESB. Let me now turn to the outlook for FY20 and beyond. This financial outlook is in line with that provided at the FY19 full-year results, with capital expenditure figures updated for the inclusion of the South Australian gas turbines. Operationally, Infogen is well positioned in the market. In FY20, we expect renewable generation to be higher than FY19, reflecting the full-year contributions of Badangara and Kiata wind farms. We've contracted about 75% of our electricity generation and 100% of our expected LGCs to customers. This contracted position provides us with high levels of revenue visibility. We expect our merchant revenue to be modestly higher than FY19 as we see the contributions from Smithfield and the SA Battery materialise. Net revenue is expected to be weighted towards the first half of the financial year, which reflects the revenue recognition of LGC contracts. The cash flow, however, will be weighted towards the second half due to the timing of the cash settlement of those contracts. Asset operating costs will be higher, reflecting the addition of Badangara, Smithfield and the Lake Bonnie Battery. FCAS costs have risen in response to the requirements of the market operator, and business operating costs will rise modestly, reflecting the full year costs for Infogen's transition business. Capital expenditure is expected to be approximately $30 to $40 million, principally reflecting the capex associated with the relocation of the South Australian gas turbines. Strategically, FY20 will be a year in which we consolidate many of the initiatives that we've implemented in FY19. Specific strategic priorities this year include: first, we will take functional possession of the SA gas peakers on their existing site at Lonsdale in South Australia in early May 2020, in accordance with our agreement with the South Australian Government. We're concurrently undertaking the planning and development work to, in due course, relocate the four units to an alternative site at Bolivar. The Bolivar site will enable us to run the plant on gas as well as diesel. This will provide us with a high degree of confidence that the plant will perform when required. We expect to be able to commence the relocation of the units in FY21. The precise timing will be dependent on the progress in obtaining relevant approvals, the commercial needs of our business, and the obligation to ensure that the plant is in service over the summer of FY21. Secondly, we will advance our program to increase the volume of renewable generation available for sale to C&I customers over the course of the next 1 to 2 years. As mentioned earlier in this presentation, if we are to achieve our goals, we will require an additional 300 to 400 megawatts of renewable capacity in New South Wales and around 300 megawatts of additional capacity in South Australia and potentially Victoria. In determining the specific projects to consider, we take account of the location of the project within the grid and its likely exposure to curtailment, the expected production profile and the extent to which it complements our existing portfolio, as well as the price and commercial terms of sale. There's no doubt that the uncertainties in relation to the potential rule changes, as well as the terms and conditions of grid access, are complicating the procurement process to some degree. Understanding the potential impact of prospective rule changes or possible future changes to market design deserve considerable analysis and assessment as part of our procurement process. At present, we're engaged in discussions with a number of parties with projects that may meet our needs. In this context, we will be continuing to advance several projects within our own development pipeline as a future source of additional energy. The 140 megawatt Flyers Creek wind farm near Orange in New South Wales is the highest of our priorities in this regard. Any decision to allocate capital towards future growth initiatives will be considered by our board in the context of balancing this objective with Infigen's other commitments to return capital to security holders and reduce our leverage. Based on our current forecast, the amortisation profile of our debt facility and our anticipated requirements for growth capital, we consider that our current dividend payment of 2 cents per security per year remains sustainable. Critical to our success is the engagement, commitment and capability of our people. I'm humbled to lead the fine team of professionals at Infigen. They've worked tirelessly to deliver strong annual results while transforming the business model over the course of the last few years. As a result of their efforts, I believe our company is now well positioned to capture the opportunities and manage the risks involved in the national electricity market as it transitions towards a low carbon future. We have a solid foundation of core assets that enable us to offer firm supplies of clean energy to our growing customer base, and our business is readily scalable and adaptable in response to evolving market conditions. I'd also like to record my personal thanks for the dedication, creativity and perseverance that the team of Infigen have contributed towards achieving this result. Due to the efforts of our people and with the support of our board, we're now in a position to deliver a clean energy future to our customers while creating value for our security holders. To that end, I'd like to thank our board for the critical role that they've played in guiding the design and execution of our strategy. The support, encouragement, wisdom and caution of our board is highly valued by myself and the management team, and I hope our security holders. In closing, can I thank you, our security holders, for your continued support for the business and our strategy. We are grateful for the interest that you have shown in our company and your thoughtful feedback. We take serious account of your views as we refine and implement our overall business plan and evaluate specific initiatives under consideration from time to time. I'll now return you to Len Gill, who will present you with an opportunity to ask questions of us and to vote upon this year's resolutions. Thank you.
Thanks, Ross. I'll now turn to the formal business of the meeting and in doing so refer you to the notice of meeting. The first item of the notice of meeting is to receive and consider the combined financial consolidated financial report of Infigen Energy and the financial report of the Trust, as well as the combined reports of the directors and auditor for the year ended 30 June 2019. These reports have been distributed to security holders and I now table them. No resolution or vote is required in relation to the financial reports, but discussion is welcome. Mr. Craig Thomason from our auditor, PwC, is here to answer any audit-related questions which you may have. Do any security holders wish to ask questions or make a comment about the financial and other reports? And if you do so, please raise your hand and wait for a microphone. And at this stage of the meeting, if we could just confine questions or comments to the financial reports, please. Is there a question at the back on the left, or midway on the left? If you could identify yourself, that would be helpful if you're a security holder.
I'm Kaz. Good morning and thank you for your very positive and encouraging report. Both the Chairman and Mr. Rolfe have given a very positive and projected a positive future. What puzzles me is if it is as good as you say it is, why isn't the market buying it and why is the price, share price, still stalled at 64, 65 cents when the capital raising was 89 cents 2 years ago?
It's a good question. I can't sort of speak for the views of others in terms of what the market may view. I'm happy to offer a few personal comments. I think one of the issues that still overhangs the electricity sector is the uncertainty on government policy. And I think we sort of have to live with that. I can't see any near-term resolution of the issues. And I think that's overhanging us and other companies. I think the second issue is we have advised you of our strategy over 3 years. And it has taken, I think the market has kind of looked at us and said, it's a very interesting story. Show us the results. And I think this year, for the first time, we've now really demonstrated that not only we know what we're doing, but we've done it. So I think we are getting some momentum into the share price. I'd like to see more, as would all security holders. But I think there are a couple of factors. The jury's been out on us, and I think the jury's starting to swing behind us. But, yes, it'd be good to have a higher share price.
What proportion of our energy is coming from wind turbines? And what I need to know is how old are these turbines? What is the life expectancy of the blades on these turbines? And when do we see a progressive diminution of the value of those turbines and blades and their energy production capacities?
Foss, do you want to take that in the first instance?
It's about wind.
Sorry, Sylvia, do you want to?
First, I do apologise for the fact that I'm not standing up. One of the security holders spoke with me last year and indicated that they thought that was rude, but unfortunately I'm anchored to the mic here, so I do apologise in advance for that.
Ideas is what matters.
Okay. The average weighted life of our fleet is less than 10 years old when you look at all the installed capacity that we've got. We depreciate our assets over 25 years in respect of all but the Badangara wind farm, which was the new 113 megawatt wind farm which Ross spoke about. We depreciate that over 30 years. Mm. And we operate all of our installed wind generation with the expectation that it will have a 30-year life. We have an asset management plan in place and they are our practices and we undertake the maintenance with that full expectation. I think in terms of thinking about age, you also should think about the productivity of wind farms. They have, they're quite costly at the outset, but as the chairman said, they have low short-run marginal costs. We have entered into long-term operation and maintenance contracts in respect of all our installed wind farm generation, and we have the same availability on the beginning of those contracts as we do on the 20th anniversary. So we've got a very well-maintained fleet of assets, and if you look at the production data that we put out to the market each month, I think that comes across that the variability in wind production is about the wind resource, which of course is seasonal, not the availability and the capacity of our plant. So we've got, you know, what is quite frankly still a young fleet. We've still got a lot of life left in them. They're exceptionally well maintained. That said, one of the strategies that Ross introduced this year was to start to turn our mind to repowering of those assets in the future, and we've started to do a bit of work around that, ensuring that we've got access to the continuing landholders who host us going forward. So we look to the future, but I think you can take a lot of comfort in the maintenance regime that we've got around the assets
what
today.
What material are they made of? Is it metal? Is it... some.
Tony, would you like to come and answer that question? Come and take the spotlight here.
How are you? The blades are fibreglass sort of reinforced. The rest of it's largely metal. So obviously the towers and the like. And there's gearboxes and generators. There's a fair bit of metal in that. But as Sylvia mentioned, I mean, they're well maintained. And that 30-year life expectancy is not unreasonable in the context of the usage and the capacity factors of that plant historically.
No, the reason I'm asking is, you know, there are natural factors like lightning and a whole range of other factors that may very well have impact on these and therefore reduce the capacity to produce the energy and or have other impacts that may, you know, result in greater depreciation and productivity.
Well, certainly on the issue of lightning, for the sites where we have, you know, a fair bit of lightning, and our site in WA is one of those, part of our asset management plans provide for us to have installed sort of lightning protectors, if you like, that allow that if there's a lightning strike, and wind turbines do have them, allow that energy to be dissipated without causing damage. So the damage can be caused, but certainly at those sites where we have a dominant lightning, we have protection in place on the sites.
Okay, thanks very much.
Just as a long-term practitioner in the industry, and I can see there's some fellow mature-aged participants in the audience, those of us who grew up with the era of introducing coal-fired generation into a growing demand profile, so in the 70s and 60s, 70s, 80s and early 90s, those assets, when they were built, sort of had an expected life of 20 to 30 years. Pretty much all of them are still operating because the engineering in these assets is first class, they're all well maintained, and as a result, they get a longer life, or you know, the bulk of the facilities are sound, so you can repower at pretty low incremental cost. So we are turning our minds to, you know, life beyond the sort of accounting depreciation life. So we've got a pretty good fleet. And, of course, we've got sites with the support of our local communities that are subject to repowering. So we think we're pretty well placed to address a longevity issue. Any other questions? One at the front here. Just hang on a second. We've got a microphone.
My name's Kevin Daly, Mr. Chairman. Now that you want to be considered as a utility, is it fair for shareholders to consider the dividend to be the main metric of your financial performance, as is the case for, say, Spark and for AusNet?
I think we're a utility in the sense of we now generate and retail to customers. We're a utility in the sense that our cash flows are now at a point where we're providing a solid dividend. But I do think we offer significant growth, and I think that message has come through quite strongly today. So, you know, we don't have a legacy of ageing coal-fired plant in our portfolio. So we're heading in the direction of getting bigger and growing more earnings and redeploying our capital as we grow, and as the opportunity there in the market is clear as coal-fired plant retires. So we're quite different to we're quite different to a lot of others in the space. So we're not a comparable utility to the majors who all have legacy aging coal-fired assets.
Lynn, could I just?
Sylvia?
I just wanted to add one thing. I think with Spark and AusNet, you're thinking about regulated rates of return, which was why those assets are traditionally judged through their distribution. As the Chairman and CEO have talked about, we're really an energy market participant, so the distribution is a very important part of the measure of performance, but in and of itself, I would say it's differentiated from Spark and AusNet in relation to... I think earnings and I think profit is a very important measure of a corporate performance. And if you think about the strategic turnaround that the Chairman and Ross talked to you about this morning, it's been over 3 years, and 3 years have been the period in which Infigen's profit journey has gone from a loss-making company into a not unreasonable profit-making company going forward. So I think that's one of the primary measures for performance and execution of the strategy.
Question?
I have a question relating to staff and job satisfaction you mentioned. I'm not sure whether this is the place where I should be asking the question or should I delay?
I'm happy to take it now.
Oh, okay. You mentioned job satisfaction was terrific. Who determined that it was as good as you said it was? And how do you motivate, encourage, recognise and reward the staff? Those are, I'm talking about those staff who are not at the elite level. I'm talking about staff people who are engaged at a lower level.
Ross, I'm going to throw this one to you.
Sure.
And we've got our human resources manager on tap if we need to dive into further detail.
Sure. So we conduct a sort of full staff engagement survey once a year, and then every 6 months, at the 6 month point, we do a sort of pulse survey on key issues that staff have raised in, you know, the earlier survey work. It's not done by us. It's done by an external party. It's based on sort of, I guess what you might say, is experience and objectivity in terms of how people comment on how they feel about their working environment. So it's sort of arm's length. In terms of, philosophy on remuneration and so on, remuneration's one important part of, our appeal, hopefully, as an employer. The other is, you know, the nature and the quality of the work. We try within reason to have sort of flexible working arrangements that accommodate people's life circumstances and so on. Our remuneration policies are really based on a sort of fair market-based basic remuneration, and then for most people, not everyone, subject to performance, some additional reward for performance against KPIs that are set at the beginning of every year, which is sort of pretty standard practice.
What I was thinking of is more educational facilities, which allows them to grow individually, grow their knowledge base, have ideas. You talked about creativity. I mean, I think one of the fonts of contributing towards this is clearly education capacity. What facilities do you offer your staff to grow their personal knowledge base and therefore contribute to the company's knowledge base and therefore being positive and productive place to work as well as, you know, contribute to the overall positive facilities that the company aspires to.
Sure. So I guess we think about that in a couple of ways. Firstly, internally within the company, we actually do have a tremendous capability of people from, you know, people with a lot of experience and deep credentials to a bunch of relatively recent graduates who are sort of at the early stages of their career. So what we try to do, I guess, is to sort of cross-fertilise the wisdom and knowledge of the older sector into the business as a whole. So on a very frequent basis, every couple of weeks at least, we have the whole complement of staff in which we have a sort of what you might call a training session. It's not really a training session. It's a sort of an educational session about a particular theme that's impacting on the market at present. Like, for example, it might be around grid access. So we have our grid experts talk to the wider workforce about the nature of their work, the issues in the grid, and so on. And we do that for sort of a myriad of different topics, and then we provide the opportunity, I guess, for staff who are particularly interested in that to pursue that internally within the company. In addition to that, we do have a fairly well-structured, perhaps not as well-structured as we'd like it to be, but a sort of a training and development program for each staff member. Now, that sort of is necessarily juggled around what the sort of requirements of the company of the time are and so on, but we do have quite a structured and disciplined approach to staff development and training.
like Steve would like study leave and things like that.
Yeah.
And yep. assisting staff to undertake studies and pay. Some
yes. Yeah, we do that.
Towards it.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Question down the front.
Thank you. Gregory Sachs. Thank you very much, Len and Ross, for a fine presentation. I've only been a shareholder in Infogen for about 3 or 4 months. But a couple of questions occur to me in terms of presentation. You and I understand the regulatory problems you're having because I worked for many years in telecommunications and I understand what, you know, the whole, some of the issues that were around then. But Ross made a reference, I think, to unsynchronised sources, which I took perhaps to be solar, like I've got on my roof and what we see on major buildings, which perhaps are backed with batteries. But the one thing that perhaps is coming, and we do hear a lot about it, is the potential for the hydrogen economy. And I would perhaps appreciate both comments from Len and Ross on such competition for Infogen. Thank you.
I'm going to make a couple of remarks and then throw to Ross. I mean, look, I'm going to link it back to the previous question. One of the things that Infogen has done is grown its business and its skills and capabilities to have a deep understanding of the energy sector. So we bet very deeply in both experience in sort of fossil fuels, non-fossil fuels and emerging technologies. The board itself gets a briefing on those emerging technologies a couple of times a year. And, you know, if I pick batteries, we're excited about batteries. But batteries are at the start of their journey. Long way to go. Some of the reports that we're seeing are saying, you know, there'll be a halving of battery prices inside of 5 years. And maybe it'll be longer, maybe it'll be quicker. But that's the clear direction. And we're getting, and we have got our minds and getting and continue to get our minds around the implications. Now, hydrogen is still some way away, but it is a technology we've got a close eye on. And I'm going to throw to Ross because we are doing a couple of things to keep our eye closely on it.
Sure. So we do actually have a modest little sort of early hydrogen project, which we're working on. It is extremely early days. To be honest, we've never talked about it publicly before. We're developing it with another small company. The issue with production of hydrogen from renewables really is the cost of the renewable energy you require, and you sort of got to get it down below $40 a megawatt hour, that sort of territory, to make it work. And you also need quite a lot of scale to make the economics work. Having said that, it's not that far away at scale in certain conditions for it being able to made to work. The encouraging thing, I guess, is that both the federal government and a number of the state governments are all prepared to sort of contribute into trying to prove up the viability of it. The other interesting opportunity with hydrogen production is as you sort of start to see the impact of particularly solar on the market during the daytime, driving prices it down to zero or negative territory. And because the production of hydrogen can be interruptible, it sort of provides an interesting opportunity as we see those daytime prices start to diminish to average down your costs and in some cases be being paid to take the energy, to get to a point where hydrogen may start to, production may start to sort of get into the zone of commercial feasibility. We're away from it yet, but you can sort of feel it on the next horizon. We don't invest a lot of resources or effort into it, but we have got a particular project and we're working with one of the equipment manufacturers on that project at present to see if we can sort of get more comfortable about its long-term viability.
Thank you for your comprehensive answer.
One at the middle and then one down the back.
Just linking to that last question, generally, I think the company is on the right way to do all these things that we were all hoping for. My question is actually, now that you realise what the government is proposing in terms of pet projects, etc., the initial response by energy companies was very muted and very kind of semi-cooperative with, yes, we will do all this, we will arrange all this. I think the response now would have room to be much more coordinated between the different energy companies, regardless of what the energy actually is, of the like interference in business transactions, interference in picking certain things that you the government will support or not support, depending on where they think they get their votes from. So I'd like to, because what you expressed in terms of your attitude was the most comprehensive thing that I wanted to actually hear from energy companies, because mostly people are sort of stepping back and saying, oh, like, I'm trying not to be too anti-government, I'm trying not to be this and that. And you had a most comprehensive response that I think is a reasonable response. And I'd just like to know what kind of action you actually take. And maybe you need to go with the public a bit more by actually putting out the figures of comparisons, because people don't really know about the Energy Council. They don't even know it exists most of the time. So there has to be maybe some more public work without being in any way antagonistic unnecessarily, but to sort of actually put the facts out there. And I'd just like to know what your detailed sort of response might be of coordinating, because I've been to APA and AGL, and they're sort of like, yeah, sort of, you know, they do agree with you, no doubt, but they don't actually voice it. And I think we've come to a point where maybe private companies are already starting to voice what they think they should be doing, and they're doing it because it makes financial sense. Thank you.
Look, I appreciate the comments. I guess our experience is we will support and continue to work constructively with our elected governments. It doesn't necessarily mean we, you know, fully agree, you know, with everything they're proposing, but they are our elected governments, and we respect, you know, the rights of citizens to vote them in and the rights of those elected officials to act as they see as appropriate. Our experience is, you know, there's a lot of collected wisdom in our company, and our experience is you are far more effective dealing through, you know, the regulatory groups and, you know, policy advisors in a non-confrontational way, in a constructive way that respects the views of the other party. And thirdly, in regards to your public engagement, I used to work a long time ago for a company whose public slogan, our advertising slogan, was, "We're excited about electricity even if you're not." And that resonated very strongly with the consumers, because I'm delighted that you're all here today, but if you really think about it, people kind of have got a lot of things on in their lives, and worrying about the electricity industry is not even on their list of top 100 things to worry about. So I'm not sure that trying to engage the public in terms of get a you know, supporting competitive neutrality would be effective, nor really respectful of the rights of the public to delegate those responsibilities as they have to their elected policy officials and elected parliamentarians. I'm going to ask Ross to just add a couple of things. I'm sure he wants to say a couple of things from his years of experience in the industry as well.
It's an interesting challenge. You know, at the moment, to be frank, the industry is more aligned than I have ever seen it being on the future direction. There is really no serious departure from that. People might argue a bit around timing, but most of the industry really is of a common view about the direction going forward, as are the two key industry bodies, namely the Australian Energy Council and the Clean Energy Council, of which we are a member of both. And everyone is of the same opinion. As I must say, all the policy advisers in the systems of government, both at the state and federal level, it's not like this is a highly contentious perspective on the world and what needs to be done to reposition the industry into the future. The debate is skewered by party political or internal political politics at the very senior level. And I guess we've adopted the approach, like the rest of the industry, listen respectfully, respond thoughtfully on each of the measures that they put out. And to be honest, I do think that is gaining increasing traction. I know that after the last election outcome, you know, we probably all felt that we'd gone a bit backwards on national energy policy, but, you know, Paul and I are closely involved in those debates and discussions, both directly and indirectly. And my sense is that the community view, the combination of economics and science, is really resulting in everyone accepting that we're going in the right direction. Now, there'll be different business strategies by individual players and maybe different points of emphasis on certain matters, but at the industry level, I think there's a lot of consensus about the direction going forward. And even within the systems of government, they actually know that as well. It's just for whatever reason, historically, politically, people have moved themselves into different positions and they're finding it hard to sort of reinvent themselves into the new world. But look, there's a general acceptance of what we're saying is a widely held view.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Down the back, Chris.
Thank you, Chairman. Richard Wilkins. I'd like to endorse what one of the other shareholders said, that I've been a shareholder in this company since the very beginning, and every year the presentations have been excellent, and I think particularly this annual report is a very good one. I've got three questions, but I hope they're quite straightforward. On page 17 and 18 of the annual report, it refers to the three sort of imminent or prospective projects you're working on for about 540 megawatts.
Sorry, could you speak up a little bit? I'm having trouble here.
Yeah, sorry. Bottom page 17, 540 megawatts on the three named projects there, and you and Ross have spoken today about a slightly bigger number of 600 to 700. My question actually is purely on one word, because it says at the top of page 18 that you will consider them either as owned projects or capital light. Now, obviously, that sort of 600 or 700 megawatts is going to be well over $1 billion. I think the way Ross phrased it this morning, the inference was that all of that capacity would be dealt with in a capital light way, not in an own way. But clearly, from a shareholder point of view, the amount of investment involved is absolutely massive. So I wonder if you could just... I was a bit surprised by the word "or" there. I wonder if you could just clarify what the strategy is.
Well, the meaning of the word "or" is that, you know, the board has yet to make a formal decision on how those projects will be funded, and it'll be one way or another. But I think we've been pretty clear and demonstrated a significant discipline on the need to keep our balance sheet in a very robust way. robust capacity, and we've already demonstrated the capacity to take our own projects, with Cherry Tree being a great example. We owned that project, we sold that project, we now own the rights to that wind that comes from that project, which is what, you know, the core asset for the company really is. So without preempting what the board will decide at the particular time, I think that's the framework in which we'll make the decision.
Right, thank you. Which financial year do you think you'll reach the target of the 75% firm? I mean, it's obviously gone up a bit, but there's still a long way to go.
Sorry, could you just...
Which financial year do you think you'll reach your objective of a 75% firm sales?
This is contracted C&I sales, you mean?
Yeah.
FY20.
Oh, as quick as that.
We're there now.
Right, great. And thirdly, it was a bit hard to read the slide on the outlook, but I think it seemed to me that there was actually no financial guidance in there at all, other than bits and pieces, and perhaps the nearest thing on net operating cash flow was to say it was going to be weighted towards the second half. No doubt the board's given a lot of thought to this, but it would be lovely to hear some sort of guidance on EBITDA or NOCF or even gross revenue, or even at the smallest, just a forecast of production and gigawatt hours would help some of us trying to struggle with how to analyse this company. Thank you.
Well, we don't provide formal guidance, but I think I'm going to throw that to Sylvia in terms of, we do provide an enormous amount of information from which people can sort of deduce the trajectory.
Yes. Hi, Richard. Hi. If you go to the full year 19 presentation materials from the 22nd of August, and I think I can refer you hopefully to slides 24 and 25, in that what we do is we give you our P50 production estimate for the year, then we break it down to electricity and to LGCs. We're pleased to report that for FY20 we are 100% fully contracted sales in respect of our LGCs, and we give you an average price of sort of $54 for those, so you'll be able to do the maths on that side of the equation from a revenue perspective. Then you look at the electricity numbers, and we've given you our five-year C&I book out for sale, and we give you an average price for that. So it's just a matter of doing the production multiplied by the percentage that we've told you sold, multiplied by the price that we've given you, and you'll be able to get an electricity revenue number. The piece you won't be able to plug, of course, is the merchant sales, but obviously you can choose your own adventure in relation to the energy price for spot prices in both South Australia and New South Wales, which is where we've got our primary merchant capacity. In terms of the operating cost, I think on that slide we do actually try to give you some very substantial guidance in relation to the operating costs have been very stable in respect of the owned wind farms over a vast number of years because of the OMN contracts that I mentioned earlier, and we do guide in relation to corporate costs. So I agree it's a bit of a task to get there, and you can obviously call me or Pete Campbell, who's our GM of IR, and we can put some more detail around that if you need it.
That's great. Thank you very much, Sylvia. Thank you.
One more question on the left.
Good morning, Anthony Pesek. Ross, you mentioned FCAS in your outlook, that we're envisaging an increase in frequency control and ancillary service costs. Am I right in saying, on the flip side, the battery that's yet to be commissioned, there's an opportunity for the revenue there to increase as well with an increase in FCAS costs on the grid? And secondly, how far away are we from having that battery up and running?
Ross, sure. Over to you.
Yeah. So the battery sort of is up and running. It's just going through its last hole point test at the moment as we speak. So it's actually been working. It's not fully commissioned as yet. Hopefully that'll be in the next week. But it is performing actually exactly as we expect it to perform. Yes, you're right. In terms of its ability to tackle rising FCAS costs. But the interesting thing about the battery is it has a brain. And so it is programmed to make the choice as to what is the most value accretive way to use its, to discharge its energy. So if that is to offset an FCAS cost or to generate revenue from it, it will do that. If conversely, it is better to sort of energy arbitrage because it'll make, create better value, it will do that instead. So it doesn't just attack one particular issue. It has a number of choices as to how its capability is deployed, and it does so on the basis of what's most value accretive. So the only reason I'm saying that is because it is theoretically possible at the end of the year that we'll actually have quite high FCAS costs, but that'll be because we will have made more revenue from one of the other functions that the battery can perform, if that helps.
One more question on the left.
I apologise if I appear to be hogging the questions, but I've been a foundation member of Infogen, and I was a shareholder when it was one of those Babcock Brown babies, only to see it go belly up and then find expression in Infogen. Now, there was one brief question relating to staff. You talked about REM for them. Do any of the staff, how many staff have you got? Because I don't get the annual report, I just get the little flyer.
Yeah,
how many staff have you got?
It bobs around a bit, but it's around 70.
Oh, okay.
A few more.
Now, do any of them get an opportunity to take up shares, and do you give them at a discount for recognising and rewarding them? No. I mean, do they get an opportunity to buy so that they have some skin in the game?
The short answer is not really. The senior management team, of course, part of their remuneration arrangements involve performance rights, but other than that, really, people are entitled to buy securities on the market if there is a window open or not. But beyond that, we don't actually offer.
I mean, you don't say you've done a great job. We'll allow you to have some skin in the game at, say, 5% or 10% discount.
One of the issues, I mean, I hear the suggestion, but one of the issues that has confronted the company for over nearly virtually 2 years now is that we've been unable to open a trading window because we've had so many things gestating, and, you know, like the battery, like the South Australian gas turbines, like Smithfield. So we've, you know, for people that would know about those things, they would actually be insiders to buy shares at that time. So we've been unable to open a trading window for directors to participate because of, you know, the successful achievements of the company. But it is an issue that still confronts us. So.
Okay, thanks very much.
Now, I'd like to turn to the formal business of the meeting. There is an opportunity at the end to ask further questions if you think of them. But we'll now move to these items requiring a security holder vote. Before we proceed with voting, please note that in accordance with the voting exclusion statement on page 6 of the notice of meeting, a vote must not be cast for any resolution by or on behalf of those persons whose interests are affected directly by the resolution or by their closely related parties. However, a vote may still be cast by such people where the vote is cast by them as a valid directed proxy and the vote is not cast on behalf of an affected person or their closely related parties. For those proxies vested in the chairman, this means, in accordance with the terms on the proxy form, that undirected proxies will be voted in favour of the resolution. And as stated in the notice of meeting, these voting exclusions apply to items 2, 5 and 6 to be considered today. In relation to the method of voting on the resolutions before the meeting today, I plan to call a poll for each resolution. There will be time allocated towards the end of the meeting for security holders to complete their voting cards for collection by the scrutineer. and further instructions for the poll voting will be provided at that time. Item 2 seeks adoption of the Remuneration Report. This report is set out in the 2019 Annual Report from page 40, and this resolution is to be voted upon by the company. But this vote is advisory and does not bind the directors or the Infogen entities, although your directors do value security holders' views and give them careful consideration when addressing policy changes. As mentioned earlier, FY19 was a further year of transformation for Infogen, where management made substantial progress in delivering on Infogen's strategy to provide customers with reliable and competitively priced clean energy. And as a reminder, some of the strategic objectives achieved during the year included investment in firming capacity through the acquisition of the Smithfield OCGT facility, as well as development and construction of the SA battery, increasing the reliability and quality of our earnings with higher contracted sales, and completing construction of the Benangra wind farm, continued deleveraging, and recommencing the payment of distributions to security holders. This resulted in senior management achieving their short-term incentive outcomes and partly achieving the long-term incentive performance criteria, as detailed in the remuneration report. Director and committee fees remain unchanged throughout FY19. The board firmly believes that the successful execution of our strategy will depend in large measure on the commitment of a highly skilled workforce served by an experienced leadership team. Infogen's ability to attract and retain talented people within an emerging renewables market is paramount to continue the execution of the strategy. The resolution for item 2 is shown on the screen. I won't read it out. The resolution is an ordinary resolution requiring a majority of those security holders voting to vote in favour for the resolution to be passed. The proxies received for this resolution are now displayed on the screen. The directors recommend that security holders vote in favour of the adoption of the remuneration report. Do any security holders wish to ask questions or make a comment about the remuneration report? Please raise your hand and wait for a microphone. One at the back.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman. Richard Wilkins again. It's a very good REM report, very well written, very clear and understandable and comprehensive. I just have 2 points, and this is really only in the spirit of feedback. The total salary packages for the senior executives are quite generous, but I realise that one can have endless debate on what is a fair amount. Also, no doubt you get huge amounts of feedback on the composition. My personal feeling would be at those package levels, I prefer to see a bit less on the STI and a bit more on the LTI. And I can understand why it's been as it has in the past, but I think as you're now moving into a different sort of phase, perhaps more LTI would be more appropriate. Also, there are a couple of references to components of the 5-year business plan being, if you like, assessed in the eligibility or the grants of awards. Given that 5-year business plan, it would seem to be apposite perhaps to think about a longer vesting period now for LTI. I mean, personally, I'd like to see 5 years, but would at least ask the board to consider whether 4 years might be the right way to go in future years. Thank you.
I'm not going to comment on every specific point you made. You know, the board has undertaken a comprehensive review of the remuneration structure, not this year, but the year prior. And we believe that remuneration balance is fit for purpose. We keep an eye on it. But, you know, I think the comment earlier about the share price and my comments about the overhang of government policy, we don't want to get distracted by things that don't create real value. We want to incentivise a highly skilled management team and workforce to deliver on creating real value. And that, in that sense, you know, we think the achievements that have been demonstrated over the last few years, but in particular the firming assets and the growth in C&I capability. You know, if I'd have been standing here a little over 2 years ago, we had one metered site, which was a legacy contract. We're now a significant C&I retailer, significant credibility, you know, invited into a lot of tenders. So the business, we think the REM structure is pretty fit for purpose, but we will, as I said, we keep it under review and I'll take your comments under advisement. There was another question, maybe it was a, okay, one more.
Charles Weeks, I'm a long-term shareholder, this is Babcock and Brown. I think your incentives are far too generous. You people have been getting incomes. Shareholders have had no income for about 6 years. How about getting a bit more dividends back to the shareholders? We deserve a reasonable return for our investment, and we are not getting it at the moment. Thank you.
I'll take that as a comment, but I will respond. Well, I welcome the applause, but there will be no returns to investors unless the company performs. And we've reintroduced distributions this year, not by accident, but as a result of a lot of hard work from the people both in this room and back in the office. So, you know, the board looks very, very seriously at the remuneration structure and also the performance of the key executives and the staff. And I do think, you know, we need to reflect on the fact that we've been able to get our balance sheet and our growth balance pretty right and reintroduce a distribution to give you some return as well as some growth in the share price of recent times. If there are any other questions, otherwise I will just continue on. For the purposes of the voting exclusions I outlined a few minutes ago, the relevant persons who may not vote on this resolution are all the key management personnel, including the directors and their closely related parties. As foreshadowed, in relation to voting on the adoption of the remuneration report, I now call a poll on this item. Security holders may wish to mark the relevant box for item 2 on your yellow voting card now, i.e. one of either for, against or abstain boxes, or otherwise wait until later in the meeting when time will be allocated to complete the voting card for all resolutions. I'm going to assume that we're going to wait till the end and then I'll give you all sufficient time in the interest of efficiency. I will now move on to item 3 on the agenda relating to the election of Karen Smith-Pomeroy as a director of the company. Karen was appointed to the board as an independent non-executive director on the 12th of December last year. Karen is currently a member of the Audit, Risk and Compliance Committee. The appointment of Karen to the board concluded the board and management renewal process that began in 2017. We are pleased to have in place a full board that offers a broad range of skills and experience. Karen has an extensive background in the financial services and energy sectors. Karen holds qualifications in accounting with significant risk management and governance experience. The proposed resolution is shown on the screen. The resolution is an ordinary resolution requiring a majority of those security holders voting to vote in favour for the resolution to be passed. The other directors of Infogen recommend security holders vote in favour of the resolution. The proxies received for this resolution are now displayed on the screen. Do any security holders wish to ask questions or make a comment about the proposed election of Karen Smith-Pomeroy as a director? Please raise your hand. There's one on the left.
Can you please have her say some few words?
I was going to do that. Karen, do you want to say a few words
on how she's going to enrich the company and the shareholders?
Thank you, Chairman. For those who don't know me, my background is actually in financial services, which the Chairman has mentioned. I've spent a large amount of time in large banks within Australia, working in the credit risk and finance and market risk areas predominantly. And a lot of my background is in the funding and lending to companies involved in power company construction and also the infrastructure and property sectors, amongst others. I have worked, as the Chairman said, with a number of energy companies over the past in excess of 10 years. And what I bring to the board, I think, is a strong understanding of regulatory settings across a number of industries, having worked in highly regulated industries over most of my career. I also bring a strong commercial lens, having worked with a number of companies and fully understanding all of the levers that drive success in businesses, working with large workforces and the importance of staff and safety, and predominantly just a different lens around risk and governance and making sure that we do the right things for the right reasons. And ultimately that's with a view to everybody being successful, the company, the shareholders and the staff.
Can I just say, given the collapse in banks' risk assessments and the disaster the shareholders are facing having to pay for the ongoing remediation, what lessons have you learnt and how are you going to apply them to your capacities?
Well, one of the things that I probably did for my sins is spend 5 years as a chief risk officer of one of the large regional banks post the GFC. So one of the things that I did in that time was actually rejig and rebuild the entire risk management framework of the entity that actually escaped Hayne fairly unscathed. So I think my focus is always on doing the right thing, and if action is needed to fix something that's wrong, it's important that it gets done and it doesn't get swept under a carpet. And I think that's one of the things that Hayne has exposed. I think the other message that comes out of that whole collapse of the banking system, without getting too technical, is that a lot of organisations are complex, Infogen is complex, a lot of companies are complex, and a lot of the important elements of managing the operations of those companies and particularly the risks is actually trying to make sure that you keep an eye as much as possible on keeping it as simple as possible so that people clearly know what to do, and as best you can you build those systems and you keep an eye on them.
Because as I see it as an outsider, the moral is that the banks and all these large financial institutions have been reactive rather than proactive, putting in place systems that would avoid having the disaster that we've had, and we continue to pay for it.
I'm going to take that as a comment.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
And you are welcome to make it at any of the bank's AGMs. If I can turn our minds, if there are no other questions on Karen's election, then I now propose to call a poll on item 3 relating to the election of Karen Smith-Pomeroy as a director. Again, security holders may wish to mark the relevant box for item 3 on your yellow voting card now, or, as I said, let's wait until later in the meeting. Item 4 proposes for the re-election of Sylvia Wiggins as a director of the company. Sylvia was originally appointed to the board as a non-executive director in April 2016 and since May 2017 has held an executive director position. Sylvia's qualifications and experience are outlined in the notice of meeting. Sylvia's board experience in investment banking and corporate and strategic advice, covering areas including energy, infrastructure, defence and structured finance. The proposed resolution is shown on the screen. I'm going to ask Sylvia to say a few words to security holders.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. It's an interesting, I reflected on this because I'm really speaking to you and asking you to re-elect me as a director, not to actually elect me into the job that I do 24/7 at Infogen, which of course as I do as my capacity as an employee. When I reflect on what I do as a board member, it really is about bringing the financial skills and the commercial skills that I've gained over many years, and to be honest, they've increased over the last 2.5 years that I've had the privilege of being an actual executive at Infogen. I've got a wide-ranging experience. I've been the CEO, I've been the finance director of previous listed public companies. I've worked a lot with government in relation to that, and I think as you've heard from both the chairman and the CEO today, we cannot underestimate the role and importance that government policy play in relation to thinking about how we think about financing our strategies going forward and the risks that we take within our business. I think there's a question as to my sitting on the board, because I'm obviously started as a non-executive director and I now sit here today as an executive director. But what I bring to the table, I think, is I think I have the respect and confidence of the board members that some of them I started with and some of them have been new to the board since my change in function going forward. I think I speak with, I get a vote on the board, and in terms of thinking about the execution of strategy going forward, the one thing that all directors have is responsibility and liability going forward. So that's a little bit unique when you think about the position that I have as both an executive but also sitting on the board. I actually have that board liability and responsibility.
But I would remind directors that in considering that we have a majority of independent directors, but it is great for the board to hear, directly from the Chief Financial Officer at the table, and to have her consider the issues with the same lens as we all do as directors. So, but I remind you, we do have a balance, a majority of independents. Okay, are there any questions? One here.
Antoinette Grant, shareholder. I just want to say it's probably no coincidence that it's two women directors get reconfirmed, because they are the last ones on the board. And I just wanted to actually say that is maybe a great idea, and it has been probably a long time in coming. So I think we expect, maybe going forward, maybe your effect has already been this year going forward. It certainly looks like that from a company viewpoint. And we would like you to really also, because of lower age, etc., to bring a new perspective on the board, which I think could be quite useful. But we'll have to see the proof maybe next year or years after. Thank you.
Thank you.
She's not as young as she looked.
Right.
Sure. We'll take that as a comment, but, maybe not the last one. But I'll take your remarks as a comment, but... it is a bit of a coincidence in terms of timing that we do have two women up for renewal this year. One, obviously, with a recent appointment, but Sylvia is up by rotation. But both of them are very valuable members of our board. So, look, the resolution is an ordinary resolution requiring a majority of those security holders voting to vote in favour of the resolution to be passed. The other directors of Infogen recommend security holders vote in favour of the resolution. The proxies received for this resolution are now displayed on the screen. I now call a poll on item 4 relating to the re-election of Sylvia Wiggins as a director. And again, security holders may wish to mark the relevant box for item 4 on your voting card now, or, as I said, I will give you time later in the meeting. The resolution for item 5 seeks specific approval for Managing Director Ross Rolfe to participate in the Infogen Energy Equity Plan. This approval is required by the ASX listing rules and the Corporations Act because Ross is a director. This resolution is to be considered by the security holders of each of the company and the trust. The level of participation offered to Ross under the equity plan has been determined with reference to market practice and within the framework of Infogen's remuneration policy. The performance rights to be awarded to Ross under the plan are at risk, with vesting contingent on the performance conditions being satisfied. The performance conditions require sustained and material improvements in relative security holder returns, as well as performance against a scorecard of strategic objectives. Other details of the equity plan, the proposed level of participation in the plan by Ross, and the performance conditions required to be satisfied were included in the notice of meeting. The proposed resolutions for item 5 is as stated in the notice of meeting and shown on the screen. The resolution is an ordinary resolution requiring a majority of those security holders voting to vote in favour for the resolution to be passed, and the proxies received this resolution are now displayed on the screen. Do any security holders wish to ask questions or make a comment about the Managing Director's participation in the equity plan?
Again, you're far too generous. Why aren't they related to shareholder return, which is less than 2% on our return on our money? and it is very poor. No, they don't deserve this at the moment. Thank you.
I'll take that as a comment. Of course, 50% relates to total shareholder return, and there are conditions regarding the allocation of those rights. So all those details are in the annual report. The voting exclusions on this item apply to Ross and any closely related parties. The other directors of the boards of the company and the responsible entity recommend that security holders vote in favour of managing director's participation in the equity plan as set out in the notice of meeting. I now call a poll on item 5 relating to the managing director's participation in the equity plan. Oh, there's another question. I'm sorry. Let me finish this bit and we'll... Actually, we'll take the question now. I'm sorry, I missed it.
Sorry, I'm just preaching to the unconverted. I always vote against this as a matter of principle. And I repeat again, it's no personal attack to any of the people because I think they're very good people. And in general, if we had heaps of money, we could potentially see our way to approve some of it. What my one of the main issues, because as you can see from the proxies, it's pretty useless to vote against it. But what concerns me most is that the board makes the conditions that they have to comply with. They don't tell us what those conditions are. If you come from a low share price, for example, it's pretty easy to get an increase in share price, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the conditions in general are pretty low and also up to the board. So when I read the just the explanatory notes, because I haven't read the annual report yet, it sort of constantly says the board may do this or that. If the company gets taken over, they may pay out everybody. All of that, mostly voters, individual voters, don't really get what that means. But it means that they are getting heaps of money when the shareholders haven't really got anything. And I do join the other gentlemen. It's very nice. I got 12. I got $10 coffees as a share as a dividend. And whilst I am not having philosophical hesitations of supporting the businesses that do the $1 coffees, at least I can think the company as such is on the right track and is a progressive company. So, but I still object to the board really making all these conditions willy-nilly, which is usually to their own benefit because they get the benefit from other companies that they are directors for.
Well, I mean, I'll take that as a comment. I think I would invite shareholders to take a high degree of comfort from the fact that, you know, we are reviewed by proxy advisors and institutional shareholders who look closely at our remuneration practices. They look at it with the same flavour as all security holders in terms of are they getting good value for money? And they look at it from a point of view of, you know, is this a package that's in market that's going to attract quality people to unlock value in this company? So they probably don't come from it a lens with you're all overpaid and deserve less. They come with a lens is this appropriate for the market? And is the discretion that the board has on certain matters also appropriate? And, you know, the board itself, when it determines what an appropriate policy considers where we think we should have discretion and where we don't need discretion, some things are far more mechanical. So we think we've got the right balance, but as I said before, we keep these things under review as the company and the environment around it evolves. Now, there's a question from this gentleman.
Not a question, just make a comment about these results. Mr. Chairman, you know, and I know, and most of the people here know, this is the most corrupt voting of any voting in the world. the most communist country, North Korea, or even the most, the opposite, Cuba, would not be game to do what you people voted on. If you have interest in shareholders, people who come to these meetings, the interest of what they have in mind, why don't you introduce democratic voting? Each person has one vote, and then you'll get the feeling of the meeting of these people. Thank you.
Okay, I'll take that as a comment.
Yes, comment. It's corrupt voting.
Okay, so I think we've taken all the comments and questions we'll have on remuneration on that particular resolution. So again, security holders may wish to mark the relevant box for item 5 on your yellow voting card now, or otherwise wait until later in the meeting. We will now move to the last item in the notice of meeting. The resolution for item 6 seeks specific approval for the Executive Director of Finance and Commercial, Sylvia Wiggins, to participate in the Infigen Energy Equity Plan. As I mentioned for this previous item, this approval is required by the ASX listing rules and the Corporations Act because Sylvia is our director. This resolution is to be considered by the security holders of each of the company and the trust. The level of participation offered to Sylvia under the equity plan has been determined with reference to market practice and within the framework of Infigen's remuneration policy. Similarly, the performance right to be awarded to Sylvia under the plan are at risk, with vesting contingent on the performance conditions being satisfied. The performance conditions require sustained and material improvements in relative security holder returns, as well as performance against a scorecard of strategic objectives. Details of the equity plan, the proposed level of participation in the plan by Sylvia, and the performance conditions required to be satisfied were included in the notice of meeting. The proposed resolution for item 6 is as stated in the notice of meeting and shown on the screen. The resolution is an ordinary resolution requiring a majority of those security holders voting to vote in favour of the resolution to be passed. The proxies received for this resolution are now displayed on the screen. Do any security holders wish to ask questions or make a comment about Sylvia's participation in the equity plan? And for the efficiency of their meeting, I will take it that the comments that were passed in the previous equity plan will also apply to Sylvia's participation. So please don't feel as though you need to repeat them for the sake of the minutes. Are there any other comments from other security holders? Okay, the voting exclusions on this item apply to Sylvia and any close related parties. The other directors of the boards of the company and the responsible entity recommend the security holders vote in favour of Sylvia's participation in the equity plan as set out in the notice of meeting. I now call a poll on item 6 relating to participation in the equity plan by Sylvia Wiggins. Security holders may wish to mark the relevant box for item 6 on your yellow voting card now. So I have now arrived at the later time in the meeting to conduct the poll voting and completion of the yellow voting cards for all resolutions. I appoint the registry Link Market Services Limited as scrutineers for the poll. All security holders eligible to vote should have received yellow voting cards when you entered the meeting. And if there is anyone who is entitled to vote in the poll and who does not have a yellow voting card, would you please raise your hand now and your scrutineers will attend to you immediately. Otherwise, for items numbers 2, 3, 4, 5 and 6 on the reverse of your yellow voting cards, would you please mark one of the four against or abstain boxes for each resolution. If you require a pen, these are available from the scrutineers. The scrutineers will collect your voting cards when you are finished. So I'll just give you a few minutes, including myself, to fill in the forms. That's the chair.
Thank you.
Okay, have all the yellow voting cards been collected? Is that a yes? Then I now declare the poll closed. Thank you for your patience, ladies and gentlemen. We'll not have a detailed result of the poll voting until all the votes are counted and verified by the scrutineer. This may take some time. The results are unlikely to be known prior to the conclusion of the meeting today, so the results will be released to the market and placed on Infogen's website as early as possible today. That concludes the formal part of today's meeting. However, do any security holders wish to ask any final questions or make any final comments about the operations, activities or any other matters relating to Infogen Energy? And I can see there's a hand up.
Wendy Clare's my name. I'm just a little bit confused. How didn't you say earlier that you couldn't give your staff but shares as rewards for their service, but they're still available for shares to go to directors? Am I correct in saying that?
You are correct, but in fact, the whilst there is, the scheme provides for those shares to an entitlement to those shares, but for the company to actually issue those shares, we need to be clean with the market. So, you know, for instance, for FY17, we're yet to actually formally issue those shares to those employees because we're unable technically to do so until we get a window.
And also, following on from what this gentleman said, just say I'm a superannuation fund and I own 6 million shares. Do I get 6 million votes?
Yes.
And we only get one vote. I might own 10,000.
No, your votes are in proportional to your shareholding.
How do you know how many?
Well, speak to the registry people because the registry has a record of your shareholding as they do of all.
But they don't. My number's not on that yellow card. Anyway, there you go.
Any other questions?
Just a final comment. Look, I've asked a lot of questions, and for all that appears to be negative, I remain committed because it's a field that is important for our future. I mean, this is very important. I've had a lot of capital tied up. I've got no returns. I remain an optimist, shall I say, and I'd like to thank you all for working as hard as you possibly can to get this company up and running. It might have gone belly up as Babcock and Brown, but I hope it does get up and do something, not only for us as shareholders, but more importantly for the environment. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate a positive note on which to end on. Are there any other comments? Then, ladies and gentlemen, as there are no further questions or comments from security holders, that ends the business of today's annual general meeting, and accordingly I now declare the meeting closed. Thanks for your attendance and your interest in the activities of the Infogen Energy Group. I now invite you to join the directors and management for light refreshments and an opportunity to discuss any further matters relating to the group outside. Thanks for your attendance today.